Hey everyone, Matt Goss here. This is the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. But I bet you already knew that because you downloaded it or you're a subscriber, which again, thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. This is the second interview with one of the sommeliers in competition for the Best Ontario Sommelier Competition, which is going on Bovine Wine Club at Union Station, January 28th. And the contestant, my guest, the SOM, is Matthew Landry, who is the sommelier for Pearl Morcette. Pearl Morcette is an incredible, not only restaurant, but also a great winery. Some of the best Riesling, and also, I mean, one of the best Cab Francs in Ontario. The restaurant, Michelin star, very famous in the Niagara area. You gotta wait ages to get one, and the menu and the food is this crazy 6-7 course food, wine pairing, everything local, just a gorgeous spot. In fact, we did the interview from Pearl Morcette, and I have to tell you, one of the more unprofessional moments in my career of doing the podcast was Matthew offered me this delicious pastry, and I'm like, oh, I'm not going to say no to stuff that came from Pearl Morcette. And I'm staring at it. We're doing the interview. And it didn't take long, like maybe a minute or two. I'm like, I got to eat this. And in the middle, this gorgeous, beautiful filling. And I'm trying to eat it and do the interview. And it's spilling everywhere. I don't have enough napkin. If you listen closely, you can tell there's a moment or two where, you know, I'm having a little bit of an issue. Anyway, we're getting off topic. But yeah, I appreciate Matthew for giving me that pastry. Great interview and really cool spot. And again, if you missed the last episode, I love these SOM competitions. I watch them all the time. I find them inspiring because you get to see the best of the best just showing off their knowledge. And by showing off, I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, this is years and years of training, of studying, of sacrifice, of looking over maps and mountains and rivers and winds. And you have to have all that knowledge as you are doing proper table service and identifying which winery from central Argentina is this. Like, it's impressive because you get to see the manifestation of their work in these very tight windows, these competitions, best on best. It's crazy. I recommend everyone. If you can go to the event, go grab a ticket. There, I don't know if there's going to be any left by the time you hear this, but check out the website and go to CAPS, which is the Canadian Association of Professional Sommeliers website. You'll find it. Or just type in BOSC, BOSC. You'll find tickets. And if there are tickets, I recommend you get it. And if not, go on YouTube. Go check out some of these videos. They're a lot of fun. So anyway, here is my interview with sommelier from Pearl Morcette. This is Matthew Landry.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I am here at the gorgeous, hard to find, mysterious, but wow, would this be a great view if you are having a Michelin starred meal. I am here at Pearl Morcette with the sommelier, Matthew Landry. Matthew, thank you so much for being part of the show today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
I'm doing a bunch of interviews. I'm trying to get as many as I can with, and we'll talk about you here, wine, your journey. But one of the reasons that I'm chatting with you is there is the Best Ontario Sommelier Competition that is going to be happening soon. For people who don't know the date of it and just what should they expect for it?
The date, I believe, is January 28th. Tickets will be on sale at through CAPS's website. And it's going to be held at the new Blue Bovine site in Union Station.
The Bovine Wine Club.
Bovine Wine Club. Yeah. So that's what James Seaton was telling me the other day. So that's pretty exciting. So it'll be a brand sparkling new, and I can take the train directly there. It's great.
Oh, that is good. So you just you drive to Aldershot, get on the GO train.
Yeah.
You're at Union Station. That is really handy about that place. I've interviewed James about it. That is what, like, just that's one of the nice things about there is that you don't have to worry about driving or alcohol.
Yeah, that's great.
By the way, anyone listening, if the dates and things change, I'm going to put a new intro with any other promo information you need for BOSC, because we're taping this in November. I love these wine events. I think they're so cool. How do you approach studying for them?
I do. I enjoy them too. I guess it's my history of kind of being an athlete, I guess, in my youth. I like competition. I think of them as sort of like the Westminster Dog Show for Psalms. There's a lot of preening and prancing. I prepare for them more or less. I mean, I'm going to the CMS, so it's kind of the same type of preparation. For this, it's just about sort of building muscle memory in terms of service techniques, the actual, like, the more specific marks you can win or lose. And then beyond that, I just try to close my eyes and imagine I am in my own restaurant to put myself at ease. And then it's just like what I do on an average night.
I got several follow-ups, but now we got to go off topic. You were nice enough to give me a pastry.
It
What the hell am I eating? That thing is delicious.
is good, right? It is a it's called a financier, and it is I believe it's made from buckwheat, and there's some sort of dulce de leche or caramel or something in it. I should probably know more about this, but it is my favorite dessert, and one of the perks of working at Promenade is anything that doesn't get sold at the bakehouse ends up at the restaurant around 6 o'clock, and the staff tend to devour them in the back room. So I've had a lot of those.
Oh my God, that's good.
It's very
And
good.
you warned me that it's gooey,
Yeah.
and I didn't listen to you.
So now we need to take a break, see?
No. We can continue. I can power through this, but it's very unsightly. I'm trying to do my best to be professional, and then I have some delicious, like some sort of jam or jelly on my hand. But you know
Yeah.
what? I'm a hero. I'm going to persevere.
It's okay. It's a podcast. It's fine. No.
Yeah, exactly. Thank God this is not a there's not a visual element here. So in one way, these wine competitions, that is all about you at your best. At a restaurant, you at your best here, just working here at Promarset.
Yeah, so there'll be different. I mean, I don't know exactly what they're going to do here, but in my experience of doing competitions out west in BC and sort of internationally, there'll be probably a cocktail component or something sort of basic where you're kind of greeting someone in a lounge like that and sort of taking some drink orders and doing that. And then there'll be probably a champagne or service element to it. Pour out this magnum of champagne into 13 glasses evenly, something annoying and idiosyncratic. And then there'll be a decanting portion. And that's just really just make sure you don't spill. And then beyond that, then there's things like menu correction, food and wine pairing. And the really annoying one is they'll just show a bunch of pictures of people or places and you have to say what they are.
You got to know what they are.
I don't know. Just that's always the part I struggle with the most, I think.
I was going to ask what, so that would be it. Like you see some sort of vineyard and you're like, wait a minute, is that in Spain? Is that in Portugal? Where the
Yeah,
hell
I
is
mean,
this?
it's kind of using context clues. Sometimes there's something very like, if they show the Hill of Grace Vineyard, it's pretty distinctive because there's that church there. Some things are a little bit more, you have to use context clues. Like if you see, it's all like iron red soil and it's gobelet train vines and, it looks kind of dry. You're thinking, okay, maybe this is Spain, maybe this is like Château de Pape. You kind of have to use your theory to sort of make an educated guess in the 5 or 7 seconds they give you.
Yeah, all 5 to 7 seconds you get. In some ways, it's almost like when you do blind tasting because you're like trying to decide what it isn't,
Yeah.
before what it is. The same way with these pictures. It's like, okay, if I'm seeing that soil, that sort of vine training, I know it's not cool climate. I know it's
Yeah.
not there. So at least that's a way of getting it down. When was your last wine competition?
Best Somme of Canada, actually in November in Halifax, November 2023 was my last one. Yeah.
Yes, yeah, I remember. I wasn't able to. I was trying to get to that. What were your memories from that competition?
So I've done the Best Somme of Canada twice now. The key is you have to do it in a second language, and that's what makes it harder at that level than at the provincial level. And I do not parlay French particularly bien. So,
Such a lore.
yeah, I know. I use that a lot, actually. So I say that. I mean, the first one, it was pretty disastrous in terms of my performance, just trying to mumble through. The second one, I guess the most recent one, my French is a little bit better. But I remember finishing third to two very very good, highly skilled competitors.
What do you remember from the blind tasting part?
Blind tasting.
Even and if you don't remember anything, that's fine. It's almost like I always love asking anyone who does the competition afterwards, just to be like what they hit on, what they didn't, what they were proud of the most, what they can't believe they called that when it was that, like just any of those sort
Yeah.
of
I
memories.
mean, I try to repress most of these things, but no, I remember I should have thought the first wine I think they poured was a Tidal Bay. So that kind of light, crispy Nova Scotian specialty. And unfortunately, I think because I do the court of Master Sommeliers, sometimes you're kind of in your head about what the possible grapes and wines are going to be. And I forgot that I'm in Nova Scotia in the Best Somme of Canada. And so it didn't even cross my mind that this was the possibility of being a Tidal Bay, which is like a hybrid blend, low alcohol thing. So I ended up calling like Cabernet Riesling after I left. I was like, oh, it was a stupid call. And I was wrong.
You know what? I want to go back. You're talking about when you do sparkling service.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you got to do a magnum. In your own experience working in the biz, do you have, like, what was, like, the toughest pour, like the giantest bottle, the most expensive one, where maybe you felt nervous opening some super old Grand Cru Chambon Moussini or something? Like, what are some of your memories of some of the toughest bottles, either by price and prestige or by just how giant it was and you're trying to pour it at a table?
You know what? I haven't worked with too many. I mean, maybe an Imperial would be the largest size I've worked with. So I haven't worked in the type of place that has those types of bottles. I remember one of the more embarrassing moments of my life was trying to serve, you know, those Belle Glow wines from California.
Yes.
Yeah. So it has that wax top on it,
but
it's a fake wax top. It's a wax top that you peel off and there's plastic underneath. And I was trying to open this at Vancouver Canucks Stadium for some people. And I did not know that because I don't drink that wine. I didn't know. And I'm trying to go through the wax and through the wax and through the wax, and actually broke my screw on my thing.
Oh.
And I looked like a fool.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was probably right after being crowned like best Somme of BC, and I'm making an ass of myself, which happens a lot.
And again, as we always say, wine's very humbling. What's with wax? Like, totally off topic. It's not part of it, but I don't know what annoys me more, wax or the novelty giant size bottles. Like, just, yeah. What are you doing, everybody?
I mean, I get it. Looks nice. It is annoying from a service standpoint, for sure. I usually try to show the bottle, and if it's wax, I'll do it off the table because there's just too much mess.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You know what actually pisses me off more than novelty bottles is novelty decanters.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Where it's like a maze. It's like a twirling
you
thing.
You have to figure out physics, how to get it out.
Yeah.
That those are, I mean, people love them, but from my perspective, it doesn't make any sense other than, like, why create this roller coaster that it has to go through to get into a glass?
I feel bad at restaurants when it's the decanter where it's really wide at the bottom and then just skinny, the skinny top. And you've got to pour it almost pour it 180 degree turn. And that one's just so unwieldy. I always thought, just keep it simple with the decanter.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, like, just a step above a general flower vase is fine.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You're just trying to get some air. It doesn't need to be.
You've got your advanced level of the court of Master Sommelier. Yeah. What are some memories of those tests? Let's start with what are some memories about studying the leading up to it?
You know, I decided maybe 2014 is when I started kind of taking this seriously.
All right, hold on then. That was 10 years ago. What made you decide to start taking it seriously? Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, man. You know, I'd worked in restaurants my whole life, pretty much in 17, but I'd never really taken it seriously. I had sort of other ambitions in life. And I sort of got to a point where I was like, either I need to go back to school or I need to take this seriously. And I got into wine because the person who did the wine list left. And it came with a dollar an hour raise. And I was like, yeah, I could use a dollar. I wanted to be a bartender. Actually, I thought that's what I was going to be. And I got really into cocktails, but there was no way to move up for the bar. And so I was just afraid of making a fool of myself. So I started studying it. And then I kind of got into it before I loved it, if that makes sense.
No, it makes total sense. It's, in some ways, you're doing it to be practical.
Yeah.
You weren't doing it because of this love of wine where you traveled in Burgundy with a baguette and fell in love with a bottle of Volnay.
Oh, I'm a suburban kid from the 90s, child of cops.
Yeah.
We drank orange juice with dinner. There's nothing romantic about my childhood with wine. So I kind of came to it on my own.
What type of restaurant was it that you now suddenly were thrust with all this additional wealth, but now a giant wine program?
Yeah, so it was it's now defunct, but it was called Yours Truly. It was on Ossington. It's a big tasting menu place, like 15-20 courses. I'd never worked anything like it. Wine pairings, and the bar manager was John Bunner, who is now the head of operations for Allo.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I have like anything close to a mentor, it'd be John. It was sort of the person who kind of convinced me that you could find creativity and do something interesting in this career rather than, you know, just try to get as many tips as possible on any given night, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of the person who inspired me. And then, so yeah, working there, feeling out of your depth and just being like, oh, I need to raise my game here. I need to not make a fool of myself because people are paying a lot of money.
Was there bottles, do you remember times when you did start, or when the moments you did start to fall in love with it? It wasn't just a job or profession or survival instincts. It's like, holy shit, this is good.
So I have a funny story about Cuvée Winston Churchill.
Yep.
Which is the Tête de Cuvée of Paul Roger. And so when I was getting certified as a Somme, you know, you do your service component and you have to do your sparkling. And the person said, I'll have a Cuvée Winston Churchill. So I go over and I get the fake bottle because they're obviously not going to pour that. It's a bottle of Prosecco. And I bring it over and I'm opening it. He goes, "Who makes that wine?" And I was so nervous. I looked down and said, "Zanotto?" and he laughed and he goes, "Excuse me?" And I said, "I don't know who makes it." And I was so embarrassed. I still managed to pass, but I was so embarrassed. I went home. The first thing I did was buy a bottle of that. Still the most expensive wine I think I've ever bought for myself. And I had that that night. And I thought, this is, I get it now.
Yeah.
I get it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this, the Churchill level sparkling is what made you start to realize.
And it's just, it's burned into my memory for just being so like flop sweat embarrassed in front of a master sommelier.
It's, those tests are so, you know, those tests are so hard.
Yeah.
How much time was your life taken before the advance in terms of just everything?
When I was first getting into it, like really decided I was going to, you know, I got my certified and I was going to go for advanced. I mean, at least 3 to 4 hours a day, probably. Mm-hmm. Theory has always been my strong suit and I like theory. I like, you know, drawing maps and all that stuff. But it took me 3 attempts to pass the advanced. So it definitely took me a while. I just passed it in 2022. So the 3 components of it, the tasting, the service, and the theory. Theory takes the most time, but it's the part I kind of enjoy the most. It was always, tasting's always been my weakest point in terms of my inconsistency. And so that was the part I kind of failed twice. So I had to keep taking the test. Finally, I passed it, thankfully. I've slowed down a bit now because it's sort of more review and just making sure you remember stuff that's already in your head. You know, it's in there somewhere. It's just a matter of categorizing it and making sure you can call it to mind. But I mean, yeah, when I was like, I remember there was a day I was like, oh, they make wine in Argentina, you know, and you're like learning really basic stuff there, but there's so much to learn, so many new grapes and new regions. And that was when I used to put in, 3-4 hours a day for sure.
For you tasting, do you have an area, like a area of strength and weakness? Like, is there one part of the world where like, okay, I'm really good at calling this. And then other areas like, please don't pour wines from this region because I'm going to be screwed.
Things I normally get would be like white Bordeaux. I find there's just something about oak, Sauvignon Blanc that is so distinctive that I get it. Riesling, I'm usually pretty good at, and particular styles of Riesling, I can usually call them accurately. I think like most people, the sort of neutral white, that sort of Gruner, Pinot Grigio, Albarino triangle, I think is
It's just mean.
And then I struggle with sort of that sort of Red Bank Bordeaux, Ribera del Duero sort of category, sometimes like Reserva Chianti, like that medium bodied, everything's sort of medium. Mm-hmm. I think I can get confused there sometimes, for sure.
By the way, we don't drink enough white Bordeaux. I find that we focus, and I get why. I mean, you know, red Bordeaux, some of the greatest wines on the planet, but I think white is very underrepresented, and it can just bring you so many different things.
Yeah, and it ages really well. It's a really unique style. It's very versatile with food. I mean, I'm a big fan of Bordeaux, and I kind of, you know, Bordeaux has definitely been waning over the last 10 years, kind of giving way to Burgundy, but I think for consistency, you know, if I have $100 to spend, I mean, a Bordeaux is much more likely going to give me pleasure than a bottle of Burgundy. Burgundy is such a hit or miss proposition that I generally go Bordeaux over Burgundy.
There's something weird about it. It's like, for wine cred, when you're in the wine world, you have to say, profess your love of Burgundy over Bordeaux. Yeah. I don't know why, but you get like more wine cool points if you choose Burgundy over Bordeaux.
I know. I mean, I'm wearing a Columbia vest right now, so I don't really care about being cool anymore.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah. I mean, yeah, for sure, Burgundy and there's all like sherry and champagne. There's sort of the things you have to hit home about to mm-hmm. kind of join. I don't know, it's the right crowds, but
it's because Burgundy inside and out. It's because Burgundy is a little bit more mysterious. There isn't as much out there. Bordeaux is more corporate. It's easier to set up a wine tour in the Medoc than it is in Côte de Nuit.
Yeah, probably. I would say, there's more romance. There's more like that sort of slightly culty religious aspect to Burgundy that I think attracts people. And I also think if you're a real wine nerd, I mean, you could just spend your entire life studying the climas of Burgundy and trying to figure out the nuance. It's so nuanced. And so it's like the World of Warcraft for wine. You know, there's no end to it. So I think that maybe that interests certain people. To me, it's like it is at a price that I can't. It's not a proposition I can do.
Yeah.
And so I kind of live off the kindness of strangers, you know, and people have been collecting, maybe people collected Burgundy 25 years ago when you could afford it. And I mean, now it's like for basic AOC Bourgogne, you're starting at $60 and you're like, what am I paying this for?
It's almost like real estate in a way. Like, honestly, I bought my place in the early 2000s, and I look at what the prices are now in Toronto. I just feel bad for young people. It's kind of the same way with wine, you know, is that if you were buying Burgundy in the late 90s, early 2000s, you're doing a hell of a lot better than in 2024.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I don't have a wine fridge at home is because I know once I have a wine fridge that I'm going to start collecting wine, and I just can't. My accountant would be too angry at me, I think. So I just I avoid it. I just try to either buy stuff library release. I'll pay extra for them to hold it for me, and I'll drink it. But I'm not going to buy things on release so much.
Financially, what you said makes total sense. Yeah. If I don't want to do that thing, I would not want someone to come down, some mythical creature, and whisper in my ear, Matthew, here's how much money you've spent on wine. Here's how much is in your cellar right now. Like, I think I would feel guilt and shame all at once if that happened.
Yeah.
So do you have anything that you have lying around in your home?
I do.
What do you got that you're saving?
I mean, I have about three or four cases just kind of sitting around in my old basement tool room. I have a 2014 Valentini Trebbiano d'Abruzzo. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably in a drinking window right now. Pretty excited about that. I have some older Paolo Schivino Canubi.
Oh,
excited about that.
I visited Schivino. That place is beautiful. That's so funny that you mentioned that one. That's one of my favorite Barolo producers. Yeah. That might be my favorite Barolo producer. Yeah.
And he's a touch more open knitted, touch more modern. He's kind of more, I don't really talk about it anymore, that modern versus traditional. But I'd say he's a little bit more modern, a little bit more earlier term drinking, which is more my style. If I could be lost in one place, it'd be Barolo for sure. Or like, I guess, Piedmont in general. If I had to be sequestered in a region, that would be where I would live.
You know what? I want to talk about Pearl Morcette, but we got to circle back. Mm-hmm. It's one of the few regions like far away that I've been able to visit more than once.
Yeah.
And anyone listening, this is nothing. The Brunellos are incredible. Chiantis are incredible. The Tuscany, beautiful. But for my money, I'd rather go further north. It's less busy. I prefer the wines. I'll take Nebbiolo over Sangiovese if I have to choose. Mm-hmm. And you can drive an hour and a half north in your Lake Country, an hour southwest and you're the Italian Riviera. To me, Piemonte is like the sweet spot wine region in the world.
For sure. And even beyond Nebbiolo, which is maybe my favorite grape, I mean, there's so many interesting red and white grapes there that don't get as much love, like Calaverga or Timorosso, Erbaluce. Really, really interesting wines being made all around that area, both in the northern part, kind of in Caremma and Alto Piemonte, and then even just getting down into like Dertona area and closer to Liguria. It's just such a, there's so much diversity, and even Altalenga, which I don't drink enough of, but I always think if I'm going to be stuck in one place, is there sparkling wine to be had? And Altalenga, I guess if I'm stuck, I could drink it. So, yeah, it's great.
It's a hell of an area. By the way, you mentioned you grew up with cop parents who drank orange juice.
Yeah.
Are their palates any different now?
They were. Like, my dad never got into it. He was kind of like a Coors Light after mowing the lawn kind of guy.
Yep.
My mom got into it. I definitely changed her as we got older. Like, they used to be that liter bottle of two oceans that would be open for 3 months in the fridge. And I kind of got her into wine. You know, she's really into, really likes Corvina. I like giving her stuff she couldn't pronounce. And so just watch her struggle. Like Valpolicella? That limoncello?
That's mean.
Yeah. So I definitely got her into that. And I got her into Riesling. Her and her sisters, they could actually pinpoint the smell of petrol, which I always thought was really interesting.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Where would I keep doing diversions, but then when you mention Riesling, we all know you called it incorrectly, but you called Cabernet. We all love German Riesling.
Yeah.
I find some regions that don't get enough love. I find Clare, Eden Valley, mm-hmm. Riesling's just so good. I always like to try to find, obviously, here in Niagara, we got a lot of really great Rieslings as well. I'm wondering your favorite non-German Riesling area.
Niagara's pretty great, actually, I would say.
I mean,
it's just the styles you want. I mean, I love Alsatian Riesling. You know, we have the, right now on our list, we have Zinnenbrecht brand, Grand Cru 2009. It's technically a late harvest, but it's gorgeous, gorgeous wine. And, you know, these are Rieslings with like 13.5%, 14% alcohol, and they're still got just a touch of residual sugar. Really, really powerful wine. So totally different than that sort of Mosel style. And Clare Valley, I do love Clare Valley. Those are wines that are usually pretty austere for the first like 5 years. So the caveat would be, you know, I want to hold on to this for, you know, 7 to 10 years before I drink it. because, you know, it kind of rips the enamel off your teeth.
Yes.
Right away.
Yeah.
But Alsace might be my favorite style of Riesling, maybe Alsatian Riesling. It's probably the most beautiful region I've ever visited in terms of doing wine tourism. But then Niagara, I mean, you know, present company excluded, because we do a very, very beautiful Riesling, very idiosyncratic Riesling. I wouldn't say it's the most Riesling of all time. But I love Charles Baker. I think he's sort of a benchmark Riesling producer here in the region. And his wines are great.
So what do people need to know about where we are, about Port Morset, in terms of, we'll get to the wine, but in terms of for dining here, for the menu?
For the menu, yeah. So it is a 10-course tasting menu. It's always done blind. So you get the menu at the end of your meal. Everything we use is sourced from within Canada. A lot of things sourced from right here on this farm. It's a sort of like hectare and a half regenerative farm. And so we do a lot of growing sort of interesting heirloom varieties and a lot of like flowers and aromatics. And yeah, you come in and it really is incredibly, I grew up in Niagara. I can't believe a place like this exists in Niagara. Like, it is so world-class in terms of attention to detail, quality of ingredient, concept, ambition, professionalism. So it was such a wonder to come work here and actually see it and be a part of a team like this. I've always been sort of smaller wine bar, casual, jeans and a t-shirt, lots of punk music, you know, that kind of thing. And so to kind of come into fit into something that's already well established and find my little role in it and really offer people a very unique and very honest and authentic experience. You know, it's an expensive endeavor to come eat here for sure. You can have expensive meals everywhere, and there can be, like, you know, you get the $75 truffle supplement and drink some Grand Cru Burgundy. There's no sense of anything unique about it, right? It's the same meal you have in here. It's here. It's all very high quality, but it's not telling a story. But I think here there is that sort of narrative element to telling a story about the region, about the produce, which gives it a certain purity, I guess. I'm not being waxing too poetic.
No. I mean, listen, this is a beautiful spot. It's easy. It's easy to start waxing. I like that about telling the story. And you're right. You can go to, you know, high-end steak restaurants, and you're right. There's certain notes, you know, that you're always gonna hit. How hard is it to get a Michelin star?
Pretty hard, I guess.
Or I guess maybe, like, what are the steps involved? Because I think people are always curious. Like, oh, Michelin star. You know, what does that mean?
First of all, Michelin has to come to your area. And that is why I think we just got our Michelin star last month or 2 months ago, I guess now. But because for a long time they weren't in our area, they're just in Toronto. So there is a lot of, this is stuff above my pay grade, but a lot of back end, like we have to work with Tourism Niagara and right. all this stuff to kind of, you know, because Michelin isn't doing this for free. So they have to come and you have to get them into your area. And
you have to get them on the Gardener. I mean, just getting on the Gardener from downtown Toronto, of itself is a
big deal. It's a shuttle service we're going to offer it. Yeah. just get Niagara Airbus warm. Yeah. And then I think, you know, it's about consistency, I imagine, in terms of, you know, unlike, say, San Bellagrino judges or Canada's top 100 judges, we don't know who the Michelin judges are. It's all a secret. And so you have to kind of assume. Generally, just try to assume that everyone's a Michelin judge, and that's how you're going to kind of take care of him. And especially when people come in by themselves, you just kind of assume.
You're like, right.
Solo diner. Okay, this is kind of like how many people come for a 10-course tasting menu by themselves.
So what I'm going to do now.
Come by yourself.
I'm going to come by myself, but I'm going to put on a novelty mustache so it looks like I'm in disguise. Like then suddenly it's like, oh. More Grand Cru white wine for you? Yes, I would. That would be
But it's just, you know, it's a matter of everyone being dialed in, everyone being, you know, everyone can explain a dish. You know, if they pull someone aside, you know, even like the food runner, the chef, the server, whoever, you know, if they say, you know, what's this, you know, is that lemon balm? Like, everyone has to know everything. So, and everything has to kind of fit smoothly. I think they see the cracks pretty easily because they're kind of looking for them. And so the key is just to be dialed in.
Let's sort of tie that in with the Best Ontario Sommelier Competition. What role does wine service and also just the wine program, the wines available, what part does that play in getting the Michelin star?
I don't know. I've heard that generally speaking, the difference between a 1-star and a 2-star is the wine list, at least talking to my European friends, that's kind of how they think about it. Generally speaking, because I would say 70% of what we do here is wine pairing. And I'm assuming that the Michelin judges are probably all got the wine pairings when they came in because it's something we offer. That to me is where you can take food and wine to the next level in terms of both showing your creativity in terms of like, okay, this is duck. Do we have to pour Pinot Noir? No, let's try to think. Let's try to be a little bit more thoughtful. I mean, maybe Pinot Noir is the answer. Maybe we can do something else. Maybe it's a Pella Verga. Maybe it's a Negromole from the Canary Islands, something, you know, and then elevate the food too. And then we also do a juice pairing here, which is really, really interesting, actually. And I'm normally, I kind of roll my eyes at non-alcoholic things because I work in wine.
Yeah.
When they're stealing my job. But but we do a really interesting juice program here. Six different juices. That'll take you through the whole meal. A lot of stuff we grow here. And I think it's the most unique non-alcoholic program in Canada for sure. And I think that's a big option too, especially these days.
What is the wine, the list here? What's the cellar like for Pearl Morset?
It's great. So, I mean, we have Pearl Morset wines, obviously going back to the kind of first cuvée back 2010, 2011. And then we have, I don't know the total bottle numbers, but everything is sort of ethically aligned and sort of aesthetically aligned with the values of the winery of Pearl Morset in terms of, you know, where we, you know, Francois doesn't love new oak, right?
I had in my head the stereotype of, I bet these are certain wines. There's no way that's on the menu.
Yeah. Like we're not carrying Belclun, right?
Yeah.
We're not carrying big, big corporate brands. I think because there's a sort of, you know, they have enough support out there.
Yeah.
They don't need their support.
Camus is doing fine.
Yeah. We don't need to pour Camus. People ask for it sometimes. And then you just try to, okay, here's this Monson that I have that's 16% alcohol. I think this might work for you, right? Just trying to, as a wine professional, and I don't select the wines here. Bobby's the wine director and he does a great job and he works with Francois, who kind of gives his opinion. But for a good wine list, I would say is like, if you're not going to carry the hits, the top 40, then sort of have in your back pocket when someone asks for that, okay, what's our lateral? What's our parallel?
Right.
Yeah. Comes in and asks for New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, no, we don't carry Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc, but let's get something, you know, reductive, aromatic, you know, fruit forward. Yeah.
And also, people listening, you can find Niagara now. It's got to be specific vintages.
Mm-hmm.
You can find plenty of Niagara Reds that would be the replacement for Camus. Yeah. It exists here. People have this assumption that all the reds are very light and thin and all that, which, you know, there's tons of places you can go to find stuff that would satisfy the Camus drinker.
Not Pearl Morset Red.
No. Oh, God.
Yeah.
No, not at all.
Very different style. But, you know, Big Head is a winery I quite like. And they use passamento on all their reds. Mm-hmm. So I think if you're drinking Niagara and you like something big and smooth and rich.
Yeah, Two Sisters could do it for you. Rene Estates, he does a good job.
Yeah.
Concert Trans Wines, Kirby, Merlot. I mean, again, there's plenty out there.
Yeah.
For the Pearl Morset wines, said this many times, the Cab Franc, I think, is my favorite. But I was wondering if you tell people, what is the ethos, the portfolio of the wines of Pearl Morset?
One is honesty. They always reflect the vintage, and there's huge vintage variation here.
Yes.
And so, like, for an example of, you know, we have the Cuvée Madeleine, which is our top red wine. It's 100% Cab Franc most years. 2016, which we're pouring on our pairings right now. 2016 was a drought year here in Ontario. It was very hot. The wine is massive. To me, it's almost like Chateau Neuf du Pape. It's savory, peppery, meaty. It was so big that they actually just released it last year, right? So they held on to it for almost 7 years.
By the way, that in and of itself, is remarkable.
Yeah.
Because the wine is where the money comes from. You sell the wine, you get the money, you pay your bills, your rent, mortgage, all that kind of stuff. But the ethos of, we want to make sure that this wine is right to drink, to hold on to it for that long, that is rare.
Yeah, they don't rush their top cuvées. And then, so a counter to that would be the 2021 Cuvée Madeleine, which was the first time ever that they didn't do 100% Cab Franc. 2021 was the rainiest year in, I think, the history of the world in Niagara. They had to throw away a lot of fruit. And they ended up having to blend Cabernet Franc and Merlot. And Svetlana likes to joke that it's the best Pinot Noir she's ever made. It's very light. It's very fresh. It's drink now. I even kind of have a little bit chilled. It's a totally different wine. And so I think the fact that they're not afraid to let a flagship wine swing on that pendulum so much from year to year is just a reflection of how they work with the wines. Flag, you know, Dix Neuf Yam is our flagship Chardonnay. And I remember drinking that wine before I ever worked here. I used to work in Toronto and I was buying wine. And I remember them bringing in a bottle of Dix Neuf Yam that had been open for 2 weeks. And they poured it for me and it's beautiful. Which I'd never come across in my life. And I think it's because they don't shy away from oxygen in the winemaking process. So the wines age beautifully. And then even once they're open, they stay lively for much longer than most wine I've ever had, actually, which is a...
That's crazy. Really, how long? 2 weeks?
2 weeks, yeah.
That's crazy. That's something that you do with port.
Yeah, I know, right? It blew my mind. I mean, that was over 10 years ago when that happened. So yeah, the Dix Neuf Yam. And then the Blackball Riesling is, I think there's three sort of main cuvées that we do here. And the Blackball Riesling is, I think, the wine you might maybe first started making. And very textured, very dry, very powerful style of Riesling that ages incredibly. We've had like 2011s here that are stunning.
What are some of your favorite food wine pairings? Either some of the classics or going a little bit off the beaten path.
I wouldn't be a sommelier if I didn't say fried chicken and champagne.
It's true. You'll be kicked out. You'll be kicked out. It's like, wait a minute. Hey, you know, as I always joke, Northern Rhone Syrah, Beaujolais, sparkling, and German Riesling. If you don't love those things, you'll have to hand in your card.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, they take away your pin.
Yeah.
that's a classic one. We do a really interesting dish here, which is probably my favorite dish on the menu right now. So imagine this, it's salt-baked celery root with caramelized cream, like super, super reduced caramelized cream. So it's almost like a yogurty texture. Potato crumble, smoked egg yolk, Acadian sturgeon caviar. Pair that with sake. Mm-hmm. Some really, really lovely Junmai Daiginjo sake. Such an interesting pairing. And I think, sake is not normally to my taste, but Bobby, our wine director, is a certified sake educator. We bring in a lot of sake here. And that pairing, because sake has a lot less acidity, it already has that creamy, rich texture to it, almost that lactic note. So it mirrors the kind of that lactic, creamy note of the dish so well. That's been a real like changer for me in terms of like changing some of my prejudices about sake. But again, that's, I don't like sake on its own generally.
Right.
But with that dish, it makes both the beverage and the dish better.
And that's the great thing, isn't it? That's one of the role of wine is to make the food better and food to make the wine better.
Yeah. I mean, you can always tell the difference between like a wine professional and someone who isn't a wine professional is they'll ask you, what's your favorite wine? And you're kind of like, what's the context? Like, what are we doing, right? Like, what am I eating? What am I drinking? What's the temperature outside? Am I floating down a lazy river? Like,
yeah.
It's like, it changes. I don't want Lafitte Rothschild if it's 40 degrees outside and I'm in my bathing suit.
Then, you know what? Give me a slightly overly processed California Chardonnay. There is a place for it, and it's the lazy river.
Give me some canned Albarino or something. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. When there's like a couple of weeks or a month or so leading up to Bosque, will anything change in your routine? Will you suddenly go Rocky IV montage where you're where you're running in the snow in Russia?
Man, I should get running more, actually, just to slim down.
By the way, I saw someone jogging today, and I'm like, it's too cold out there for jogging today, and in shorts.
Yeah, and it was. Yeah, I got shorts. My favorite weather is sweater on top, shorts on the bottom. But you know what? When is this going to air? I don't want to give away my secrets to my competitors.
No. This is going to air just a little bit before the start
of it. All right. Okay. I still want to give Christoph that edge, you know?
Yeah.
But my thing that I always do in the month leading up to it is at that point, it becomes about producers. And so what happens is in these things, they always, especially for food and wine, they're always asking for producer recommendations. And they always want to do like some sort of, we want a here's this 5-course tasting menu. We want wines all from California, but each wine has to be from a different AVA or something. They always have that thing.
Right.
And so then it's just creating dozens and dozens of different scenarios where it's like, okay, I have to do a 5-course tasting menu with only sparkling wine, or I have to do a 5-course tasting menu with only wines from Southern Hemisphere. And so just having in my head, okay, can I name 2 producers of sparkling wine from the Southern Hemisphere? Can I name 3 different white wines, 2 rosés, 3 reds, and a dessert wine? So that when it comes, it's just there. I don't have to sit and think about it. That's my one tip for planning these things. It's about muscle memory as much as possible.
And yeah, that's good. It's a good plan of attack, and it's something that's always in these competitions. So, you're getting yourself ready for it. Do you spend more time? Like, will you be a little bit more focused on it, or does your routine pretty much stay the same?
I'll ramp up the service practice, like full, like Garrett on serve the queen sort of service, which we don't do here. And but I've done it enough. It's just kind of fine-tuning and remembering, like, those little points. The ASI has a whole guide, like they'll show you the points you get for certain things and how you lose points. So just rewriting those out and fine-tuning that. So it'll be more about service and sort of scenario planning. The theory will probably start to take a backseat because we've already done the theory part. So less flashcards about like minimum must wait, that kind of nonsense.
Probably not a lot of must weight
Yeah, it's weird. You don't get asked about must weight at a table often.
yeah, no, not a lot of fine density. Actually, you know what? It's not really putting you on the spot because we're in the area. You're not allowed to pick Pearl Moor set. Four course, five course meal, five Ontario wines,
Ontario wines.
five Ontario wines that you would have.
Sparkling. I would probably go maybe the Cape Springs Blanc de Blanc. Delicious. And then we'll do a nice white wine. I might recommend, I'm going to start, I'll do Charles Baker, Riesling, maybe an older vintage, maybe 2018. Just a little bit of development there. I guess it depends what we're having. Then I'm going to a nice rich white. I'd do a big head, the Raw Shannon, which is incredibly rich, really textured, instead of doing a classic Chardonnay territory. Might do a, I really like Batch Elder's wines. The Wismer Vineyard, I think it is the Gamay. And then for dessert, Stratus's 2021 Botrytis Affected 70.
That'd be a great, that'd be a hell of a list.
Yeah, we don't get botrytis too much here. We get every other type of rot. So when
Yeah.
you do get botrytis, it's a nice treat.
Yeah. Wow, that sounds like that would be a nice flight, and I would look forward to pairing that with a wide variety of foods. Hey, Matt, this has been great.
Thanks.
I really appreciate you taking the time. I wish you nothing but the best when it comes to the competition. I think my advice for people for Pearl Moor Set is A, try the Cab Franc. B, leave a little bit early, because if you have bad sense of direction, this place doesn't make it easy for dum-dums like me.
We don't like we don't like signs, we always say. We try to
Right.
make it as mysterious as possible.
Have you guys actually, I should have ended this. I was just about to end it, but then I just have a question. Have you guys ever had like the party bus where the stagette suddenly roll down the little dirt road here?
Yes, we have. It's pretty funny because then they get turned away because everything's by appointment.
Yeah.
So they do get turned away.
Yeah.
But every once in a while, we'll have people like in dinner service, people will walk up, like a group of people, and they just want to buy wine. And there isn't, we're, it's probably our fault. There's confusion between the winery and the restaurant. And so a lot of people will just walk up the stairs and, we're in the throes of service and they'll be like, oh, I want to buy a case of wine. And you're like, oh, you don't turn them away because you want to sell a case of wine. But you're like, I really have a lot of stuff to do right now.
Yeah,
So,
there's a guy sitting by himself, and we think he
who might
might
be a
be,
Michelin judge.
yeah,
Yeah,
might be
I
the
know. Now I got
Michelin
to pack up
judge.
all this wine for you. Yeah. So my advice is, if you want to come, email. I think it's melissa@pearlmoreset.com, and she's the head of hospitality here. So she'll take care of the wine tastings. Otherwise, Cape Springs is right next door.
There you go, and go get their Blanc de Blanc.
Yeah, it's delicious. Yeah, and it's right by our bakehouse, so you can have the little financier, and then you go get some sparkling wine.
My hand is still a little bit sticky, but we'll deal with that. It was well worth it. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on iTunes, Apple, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.